Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hi, I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys and the occasional guest who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. Once again, we have two very special guests here with us. Twin Cities actor, geek, and game enthusiast Tim Uran.
Hello.
And some guy named Scott Glancy.
Yeah. That'll be me.
Yeah, I think he's a role-playing...
Parasite.
Parasite, that was it. Okay.
Role-playing game industry parasite and poser, Adam Scott Clancy. Buy my product!
We are glad to have you, whatever your noun is. And now let's just go right into round one. Temporal grace. Sometimes we can get a little curmudgeonly about this show we love, and so that's why we like to take a moment at the top of each show to say something that makes us uncharacteristically happy about Doctor Who. Pat?
Well, hopefully Scott will appreciate this as a fellow Civil War buff. So I want to read out a short quotation from Bruce Catton's book, Mr. Lincoln's Army, which is his first volume of his History of the Army of the Potomac. And this quotation comes from his description of the Battle of Antietam in 1862. Quote, "The battery withdrew readily enough, as ordered, getting into a more sheltered spot where the rebel fire wasn't quite so bad, and apparently from nowhere and by magic, there appeared a well-dressed civilian with a two-horse carriage who drove up without paying any attention to all the bullets, pulled up his horses, alighted, and began to hand baskets of ham and biscuits to the dumbfounded gun crews. This done, he invited the wounded men to get into the carriage so that he could carry them back to a dressing station. As they got in, he walked forward to inspect his team, a shell fragment having slightly wounded one of his horses. Satisfying himself that the animal was not badly hurt, he saw that the wounded men were comfortable, waved his hat cheerily to the astounded battery commander, and rove off. An unnamed man of goodwill who shows up briefly in the official reports and then vanished as mysteriously as he came." Well, I think we all know who that was, don't we?
I love the idea of the doctor just showing up to give people ham and biscuits.
Were there jelly babies stuck in those baskets, or do we have any more intelligence?
Yeah, if it was jelly babies, it'd be the fourth doctor. If it was celery, it'd be the fifth doctor. If it was
acid baths, it would be the sixth.
If it was Grumble Jack, it would be the sixth doctor. So I don't know who the ham and biscuits doctor is.
Clearly, we haven't gotten to that doctor.
A much later incarnation.
I think Peter Capaldi could.
Capaldi could be the ham and biscuits doctor. I don't know.
Maybe that's John.
Although he wouldn't be nearly as cheerful. Plus, no hat. I went to Baker because hat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't say he waved his fez, so.
Baker and McCoy are the hattiest doctors, yes.
Scott, what's your happy thing?
My happy thing for the moment is that there is still time for Peter Capaldi's doctor to say the line, "F***ity bye," before his tenure as a doctor is over with. If there was ever a line more perfectly crafted for Peter Capaldi to regenerate on, I think that would be it. I will also accept it if he's throwing an unwanted companion out of the TARDIS.
Or more likely, a group of school children.
Is yes.
Excellent. Well, you know, I am still on my book kick, and I recently read Corpse Marker, written by
Christopher Boucher.
Yes, and it is a sequel, obviously, to Robots of Death. It was written in 1999 as part of the BBC Past Doctors books and recently reprinted. It features once again, Doctor Number 4 and Leela, as well as all the surviving members of the Stormmind 4, Toos and Pool and Yuvanov. It fills in more detail about the founding families and the robot-dependent culture of Kaldor City. And it also features a minor character from one of Boucher's Blake 7 scripts.
Yay.
Putting Doctor Who and Blake 7 in the same universe. So it's quite exciting in that way. It's kind of a bit of a slow book, but Boucher's characterization and dialogue and fill-ins about the culture really make it a fun read. One of my favorite parts about it, well, two favorite things, is that there's a bit where he has a new trend among the founding family youth culture where everyone dresses and acts like robots, which is really ridiculous, but in the world he creates seems really authentic and funny. And also he is the creator of Leela, so all the dialogue from Leela and when he goes into her head to write things from her perspective are all really just spot on. And since it's not an episode of Doctor Who, he can be far more graphic about the violence. I mean, off the top of my head, I think she breaks a guy's arm, stabs two guys in the heart, cuts some guy's throat down to his spinal column. So, I mean,
these are the important details in Cell Leela.
Yeah, this is hardcore Leela. Yeah, so if that sounds exciting to you, read this book.
My temporal grace is game-related, although not role-playing game-related. I have lately been playing an Android app. I don't know if it's available for iTunes. I did not do the research. But it's called Doctor Who Legacy. It's a free game. It runs on an engine, a sort of game mechanic engine of jewel matching. So it's a little grid of colored jewels. You're moving
Candy
around.
Candy Crush.
Yes, much so. You put together a team of a particular doctor and various companions from the entire history of the series. Although, it's jewel matching, so it evokes as much Doctor Who as jewel matching can.
Yeah.
That being said, there's so much chrome from every conceivable companion, every conceivable doctor.
My son's a big fan of this, and as I understand, they keep adding new characters along the way, too.
Yes, new costumes. Yes, I've loved it. It's been a lot of fun.
Kelvin?
Someone posted a link on Facebook, a link to something he found on eBay. Apparently, in 1971, Sugar Smacks cereal in Great Britain as a premium was offering Doctor Who buttons in boxes of cereal. And someone was selling a button of the Master. Like 1971 era design button of, you know, a drawing of Roger Delgado's head and the logo, you know, the Master. And was selling it on eBay in Great Britain for £25, which would come to about $38 American, roughly. You know, and I kind of looked at it, was kind of thought for a second, and then I realized, you know, I'm not a collector, and I'm recently unemployed, so I'm not going to be buying early...
Roger Delgado's face!
Roger Delgado's...
Sugar Smacks!
Sugar Smacks!
I dig them!
I can't... I can't buy collectible items right now, so I kind of put it away. And Facebook's marketing algorithm being what it is, like periodically, the eBay sale, or the little picture of the Master button would show up, and like, it's still available, you know. But I was just very entertained that Sugar Smacks in Great Britain had Doctor Who buttons.
You know they pack 6 grains of sugar into every grain of sugar in Sugar Smacks.
I was kind of surprised Sugar Smacks are called Sugar Smacks in Great Britain.
It's toddler crack.
I thought they would have given it something like, I know, some
Fussy
more
Pants.
Fussy Pants, you know, some more British-y name.
Irish Baby.
Irish Baby Sister.
Irish Baby. Thank you, Mr. Swift.
So now, time for round 2. Special topics, Dalek. And Scott, would you like to give us our special topics, Dalek?
Oh, yes. That was on me, wasn't it?
It is.
Discussing the Doctor as an extension of those pulp characters like the Shadow or Doc Savage or G8 or the Spider or any of those kind of 1930s and 1940s, shinier than everyone else, a little bit taller than everyone else, a little more competent than everyone else characters who turn up in that kind of fiction. because the Doctor is serialized. Its form reminds me very much of the pulp serials and the pulp stories from magazines like Weird Tales or Astounding.
That raises a lot of interesting areas for discussion. One is that the characters that you've mentioned, Doc Savage and The Shadow and those are all American characters, because the pulp magazine tradition is an American tradition. And it tends not to be serialized, like a 19th century Dickensian novel.
Bulldog Drummond is the British version I can think of.
I'm thinking Bulldog Drummond, I'm thinking Raffles.
Biggles.
Biggles.
Don't forget Biggles.
Biggles. I'm less familiar with the British tradition of pulp adventure stuff. But the really over-the-top ones, the ones that you're talking about, Doc Savage and the Spider, those are American. But you're right that they are similar in a lot of specific ways. Doc Savage, in particular, had companions. He had five dudes.
The Shadow had also his
operatives.
Operatives.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, the earliest Shadow stories were not told from the Shadow's point of view. They were told from the point of view of the companions, who almost never got to see the Shadow in person. The Shadow would send them assignments. The Shadow would give them, things to do. Sometimes the Shadow would show up as a Deus Ex Machina plot resolution device.
Sort of a New Adventures Seventh Doctor.
It's an interesting question. I associate the Doctor with a very different sort of tradition than these pulp traditions, because the Shadow, the Spider, these guys, they're hyper-violent, and they really lead to the American comic book superhero tradition in my mind. And
yes.
The Doctor comes out of, Conan Doyle, the more eccentric strain of British popular fiction. We talked about Raffles and Biggles and that kind of thing. And so
even Professor Challenger.
I think story-wise, though, there is an influence. Hinchcliffe and Robert Holmes are really influenced, obviously, by British stuff, but I'm sure they read those American pulps as well. And those stories, even though the Doctor is not as violent, those stories surrounding him become darker and more grim and more grisly. I mean, Talons of Wang Chiang is straight out of a Shadow pulp. Certainly could. I mean, it has other influences as well, obviously, but story-wise.
One of the things that the Doctor is very pulp-ish is that the story never ends. It just, there's no real progression to the Doctor and his story, not like if you're reading, any normal novel, where there's a character arc where somebody starts in one place and he travels through certain things and then he gets to a particular place and then the story ends. The pulp stories, as well as Doctor Who, continue indefinitely. They just go on. And so it's constant variations on the same themes and with new ideas injected into it. I guess the one thing that I would say, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, one of the reasons that I like Doctor Who so much, as opposed to some of these, say, timeless pulp stories like The Shadow and Doc Savage, or their later descendants in superhero comics, is that there's a built-in tragedy to the Doctor's stories. Inevitably, the Doctor will die. Yes, of course, he'll regenerate and he'll go on, but there is a character arc and there is a tragic ending to all of those Doctor stories. So in that way, I think it's fundamentally different to The Shadow or Doc Savage or The Spider or G8, where those things were designed to go on forever without any real change.
I'm trying to think of comparing Tarzan to Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Burroughs Tarzan is a very erudite, relatively. He was very smart, but that still had a lot of the violent aspects.
But yeah, if you set aside the violent aspects, a lot of the similarities with the Doctor's character are that he has all this obscure knowledge, and that was something that all these pulp characters had, whether it be in the mystic East or through obscure science.
Or being a white man in Africa.
True.
One of the problems with some of these pulp stories for me is that, and it's a problem for me with the Doctor as well in some ways, is that even though, say, Doc Savage is surrounded by the Fab Five, and each one of them has a specialty that they are, super good at, they're never as super good as Doc Savage.
Yep.
There's the guy who's the electronics whiz, there's the guy who's the chemist, and there's the guy who's the engineer and the lawyer, and yet none of them are as good as Doc, which makes me wonder why he clutters up, the Delgado Trading Company with these hangers-on who aren't as good at this as he is. Sadly, that is one of the aspects that I wish would be a little different in some of the Doctor Who stories, where there are things that he is not necessarily as good at. And the stories that always work for me the best are ones where the companions get to do something that he can't, or do something better than he can, or better than he does.
Yep.
His super hyper competence, which is one of the things that I connect to these characters, is something that seems overly pulpy, and something that I could do with less of, honestly.
I agree with you, and I think that it's been negotiated in different ways over the years. Like, sometimes the Doctor is positioned as so eccentric that these things don't really matter so much, and sometimes, especially in the new series, he's shown as being incompetent in certain areas, usually emotional areas, by some of his companions. And so they try to undermine that sense of hypercompetence that he's done.
This runs hot and cold in Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah.
I go to a planet and I don't know who these people are, I don't know what's happening here, and I have to discover it. Versus I go there and I have to explain to the companion what's going on here.
I've moaned about this on the show before, the whole idea of heroism, I think. Just like the idea that somebody is a hero is kind of fundamentally antagonistic to how I view the world, and I only accept it in Doctor Who because I love Doctor Who very much. But we're no longer in that sort of naive sense where we can see just, oh, it's the Doctor, or it's Doc Savage, or it's the Shadow being the hero who's going to save everything. It needs to be a little more democratic than that, and I'm very happy with that development, but it means that in the new series, they have to kind of take this old structure, and they need to modify it in certain ways by making the companion, usually by making the companions more competent.
Tennant really felt like one of the absolute pinnacle of the hyper-competent. You know, he's going to save us all, Doctor.
Yeah.
To the point where it got absolutely messianic. And if not messianic, then a little bit weirdly Tinkerbell thing where you just have to believe in the Doctor and clap
yep.
your hands.
Well, yeah, I got it.
And he'll fix everything with his fixie dust, you know. That aspect is not, that's not a pulp aspect, but the hyper-competence thing is that there's nothing outside the characters. There's no field that is outside. Not only outside the character's, you know, skill set, but that no one else is going to, he's not going to run up against somebody else who knows it better than him.
Well, yeah, it's part of this whole, especially in the 10th Doctor era, where they had to, like, underline, look how cool this is. And it's like, we're not idiots. We know it's cool. It's Doctor Who. I mean, durr, you know, but like they had to have people always commenting on, oh, he's good, or oh, that's incredible. Or
well, the classic series often undermined some of his hypercompetence by making him annoy people, by making him rude, by making him not always loved, by making him leave in the TARDIS at the end, and people were kind of like, thanks for saving us, but I'm really glad this guy's gone now. You know?
We just talked about the Seagulls, and I keep hearing about John Pertwee's radio device blowing up in his face.
All right.
After he's being all smug about how it worked, you know. Me, I personally thought that was great.
You wouldn't expect that to happen to Doc Savage.
Oh, that never happens to Doc Savage.
Yeah.
That I can ever think of. That's one of the problems.
Doc Savage never rolls a fumble.
Yeah.
No, he does not. Certainly everybody around him does.
So I guess the final thing that I would like to say about this is that one of the other elements in which they're similar is what the cultural studies people call remediation these days, where they easily travel from one medium to another. So like The Shadow started as a radio show, in fact, just a radio announcer.
Nothing except the voice that says that before introducing a Twilight Zone-style episodic mystery show.
Yeah, and it was so engaging to the audience that he got his own radio program, and then eventually his own pulp magazine series, more than one, I think, running simultaneously, and then, of course, in serials, and then in comic books and things like that. Similarly, things happened to Doc Savage.
And an important film with Alec Baldwin.
I love that movie.
It all comes to a rest on Alec Baldwin.
But the Doctor has traveled in that way right from the beginning, too. yes, he started on television, but almost immediately he was in comic books, mm-hmm. and then he in the Peter Cushing films, which we'll talk about on future episodes, no doubt. And, you know, in role-play games, which we're going to talk about later. So there is something about these types of pulp characters that translate easily from one medium to another. You don't see Hamlet or Macbeth necessarily doing that kind of thing.
The only Doc Who comic book I can remember was one set in some sort of alternate Earth Roman Empire.
Yeah.
The Iron Legion. Was that 2000 AD that showed up in?
No, it was in Doctor Who magazine.
That was the first Doctor Who story that was a comic story that was widely published.
Yeah, and you would be forgiven for thinking it turned up in 2000 AD because it had all the same writers and the same artists.
But I actually quite like that story, but that's a topic for another day.
Oh, yeah. It is. We're going to wrap up this round right now, as a matter of fact. Good topic. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah.
We could probably have spent the whole hour on that.
We're moving to round three, the randomizer, and this is the time when we normally discuss a randomly selected Doctor Who story. But this time, we let our guests pick a story they want to discuss. And so, Tim, what are you discussing and why?
I want to talk about the Robots of Death.
What?
Ooh.
Hate it.
What? Tim, do you have a count on how many times of death is used in a Doctor Who title?
Well, could not begin.
We're back to our pulp discussion there. The titles are very pulpy.
I'm going to have to Google that.
The reason I chose it was, one, as a child, I watched Doctor Who very sporadically, not very often, and didn't really have a concept of it, of like I enjoyed it. Like, oh, I'm watching this thing and I like it, and now it's not on and I've forgotten about it. But Robots of Death, as I understand, came out the earliest on DVD?
Shortly after The Five Doctors, I think.
So it's one of the first things I saw on Doctor Who where I was specifically watching it. I want to watch some Doctor Who, and I enjoyed it. And also thinking in terms of our game discussion, I think this series is interesting to talk about, this particular series of episodes, interesting to talk about in terms of sort of a sandbox for an adventure to take place in. Maybe unlike the Sea Devils, which we discussed before, it does not represent the best character choices, but as far as an adventure to present to players, it has a lot of interesting plot things going on.
It's clearly a con game because it's 10 Little Indians.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
It's Agatha Christie in a weird robot future.
Oh, so many things, though. It's Agatha Christie, it's Asimov and the iRobot stuff, a little hint of Dune with the sand miners. There's a lot of science fiction.
If I remember reading someplace that it was basically the direction that was given for this story was like, do a Doctor Who Dune mashup. You know, they didn't phrase it that way.
My specific favorite thing is the NPCs. The background characters are wall-to-wall fascinating and fun.
This has to be one of the best, I think, examples in classic Doctor Who of world building in a single episode.
Well, Josh, you mentioned Chris Boucher's novel Corpse Marker earlier. This is, of course, the story that's a sequel to. And everything about this is great as far as world building goes. All the little characters have interesting backstories. And there's just lots of great world building suggestions. Things like, could they be ore raiders? And then that gets a sneer. There's no such thing. This is good stuff that just implies, oh, there's a whole world out there where people believe certain things and disbelieve certain things, and there's
a hint of wealthy old money kind of families that are sort of running everything.
Families.
It doesn't bury the class issues. There's lots of management and labor stuff that people are at loggerheads about.
Yeah.
And Ulyov, I could have just watched him do his shtick for another day.
Oh, Ivanov is so
Ivanov is great.
Ivanov, sorry, yes.
Yeah. And he's so layered because he's not, at first he seems like just the bad guy of the piece.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they literally paint him as the asshole who's going to do everything wrong, get people killed, and then we're all going to cheer when he finally gets killed for being stupid. And they jerk that rug out from under us halfway through.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's, you know,
that very comfortable character trope is just completely undermined, and I really like that.
He seems to be the character who came from a more working class background than the other characters and fought his way into a management position and is now a vindictive
So it gives you a very a more complex character, and then it also serves, again, on the Agatha Christie front to be the red herring character, which is a classic mystery character, too.
And I love the robot who has disguised himself as another robot.
That is D-84?
Yeah. Oh, D-84 is one of my favorite supporting Doctor Who characters of all time.
Yeah.
I just absolutely love
him. So his death has to be one of the most heartbreaking
all
deaths in Doctor Who, right?
Like, I remember watching this for the first time as a kid, and I was so hoping D-84 would become a new companion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would be fun.
A better chameleon.
And easier to manage, just a guy in a suit.
Yeah.
I totally copped it, because we got together, this crew and I, to play through the Doctor Who Cubicle 7 role-playing game, and there was a draft of that game that I was preparing for you guys that had that robot.
D-84.
Wow.
And I mean, it's been said a lot, but that the design of the entire episode and the design of the robots,
the Art Deco stuff,
is just gorgeous.
The hats. Let's not forget the goddamn hats.
Yeah, it really seemed to be like suggesting this sort of future, more decadent kind of society where, like, everyone just kind of lounges around and the robots do everything for them, and like, oh, I guess we have to go to work now, and they just kind of go and do the little sand mining thing for a few minutes, and then they go back to like lounging around and getting massages from robots and things, and with the Egyptian eye makeup and the elaborate costuming and everything, it's
they're on a mining machine and they're flouncing around and stuff that looks like something out of Chinese opera.
It really
they should be there in full kabuki makeup.
Yeah, the overall design of this episode was
Calvin's just opening a beer, everybody, just in case you didn't catch up.
I'm opening a beer and it spurted again.
But Calvin can't open a beer without spurting. Exploding over my entire
I love
carpet.
Beer a lot.
Any right-thinking American.
No, thank you. But, you know, the overall design of this episode really caught me as a kid because it was just absolutely like nothing I'd seen before.
Well, it's great stuff, and it's totally of a piece, too, because it's all interiors, and so everything from the sand miner down is designed, and it's designed as part of the same look. I personally find the headgear, like, hilariously over-elaborate, but everything else about it is terrific. The design of the robots, the design of the nightgowns, and the walls, everything is great.
I love how you can't tell the nightgowns from their work clothes.
and this is a weird thing, but I'm rather fond of the Laser Sun probes, because like it actually seems to be like a brand name.
Because a man named Laserson.
Yeah, like
it's a laser.
There's a rack of them, and there's like a logo that says Laserson on it, and it doesn't seem to like fit in perfectly with the rest of the ship. Like it's actually
like product placement.
It's like vice grips or something. And I thought that was cool for some reason.
A private company that paid a lot of money to get that placed on the sand mine.
And D-84's little comment about them, like, yes, they can punch a fist-size hole through a metal plate or pick apart the crystals of a snowflake. And this really poetic description of what
which was clearly made by an ad agency.
It's
programming. So, you know, like every time he says Coke, which is refreshing and delicious.
Yes. And as much as I want to continue to heap praise on this episode, the denouement is hilariously brief.
Oh, yeah, well, the mystery.
Hilariously, shockingly, half-strangled by robots, and they just go, well, we're f***ing off, we're leaving now.
Yeah, oh, that's wrapped up, let's go quick.
She's like, shouldn't we check on them? Leela actually asks, shouldn't we check on them? And Meeker's like, they're going to be fine. Uvanov had a robot crushing his throat with giant mechanical hands like 2 seconds before, and Baker's like, I gotta go pee, so we're going in to get into the TARDIS and leave. Like, I mean, he jumps the TARDIS like he's overdue for a piss. It really was shocking. It was like, well, we're out of time, go. Like, they just ran out of footage. Like, they looked at the camera, we got 3 feet left. Get in the TARDIS.
Scott's right. They leave before anything is ever resolved.
It is suspicious. Like, we got to go. We got to go right now.
Yeah, this is all our fault. We got to go.
I personally really love that short ending because I think, again, we're talking about authorial intent. With Leela asking that question, I think to some degree, maybe it was they ran out of time, whatever. Someone had the intent to make it a character moment with the Doctor.
What a dick.
But he never stays and cleans up any sort of mess. He's not going to sit down and give Poole some counseling.
Okay, I've overthrown the dictator. Now you go and form a government. Always, bye.
Yep. I'm done. Sure that now that Louis XVI is overthrown, everything will work out with this Committee for Public Security. Bye-bye. Good luck, Robespierre. There's no aftercare with the Doctor, shall we say.
Never.
No. He's not big on follow-up.
And this one was one of the most shocking I've ever seen. You'd figure after he picked up Leela on a planet that has a giant Tom Baker head on it, because he screwed up that time, he'd be a little more careful. But no, he's just out of there.
I want to mention my favorite scene in this episode, and that's the opening sequence where the Doctor explains
the TARDIS, the transdimensionality.
Oh, yes, thank you. I can't speak anymore.
I really like that. Yeah.
I loved it as a kid because actually as a kid I watched it and went, oh, I was Leela watching this when I was 14.
Yes.
And I went, that makes perfect sense. And that in the big picture, what I love rewatching every time I rewatch Robots of Death, it's one of the rare episodes of Doctor Who where I enjoy it pretty much on all the same levels for all the same reasons as an adult and when I watched it when I was 12 or 13.
It's at this really weird, sweet spot of cleverness where kids can follow what happened and be impressed by it. Like, screwing up the voice recognition system of the robots by releasing a bunch of helium. That's like, oh, that would totally work! Wow! You know.
It has to be said, though, that even as a kid, the resolution to the mystery is pretty bad because the image of Taryn Capel on the scanner is clearly Dask.
Yeah, that was a dead giveaway, but all signs point to David. Was his name Bailey? Was that his name? David Bailey?
Poole?
All signs point to David Bailey even before you get to the monitor, but the monitor seemed stunningly ham-fisted.
Yeah, I don't know if the optical effect was supposed to be more obscuring, but
a continuity editor who thought, oh, the audience already knows who it is, or...
Well, it seems that Tom Baker knows it at the end, at the top of episode 3, because he's like, oh, he clearly knows where the damaged engine units are, or whatever, when Dask goes off. So it's like,
I'm sure he'll find the problem and correct it.
Yeah, because he did it. Because he did it in the first place. So, yeah, tracking back the logic through the episode is a little bit fuzzy. But, so we got to wrap up the discussion on Robots of Death.
Most mysteries.
Wrapping up, we got to point out that our Blake 7 connection is Brian Croucher.
Oh, well, yeah, there's a lot of Blake 7 connection here. Chris Boucher, who wrote this episode and who wrote the previous one, Face of Evil, was the main script editor on Blake 7. So most of those, I think, first and second series Blake 7 scripts are credited to Terry Nation, but Terry Nation never wrote a script anywhere near as good as the stuff in the first couple seasons of Blake 7. Chris Boucher was a script editor on it, and he was obviously the guy who did the good work on it. And I'm sure that some of the background, the set stuff in Robots of Death wound up on Blake 7.
The other thing I wanted to throw out that actually surprised me in the episode very much and felt, I don't know, strangely out of place. Maybe I'm talking out of the side of my head here, but the scene where one of the robots finally breaks into Tusa's quarters and is going to murder her, that actually bothered me on the grounds that they got Pamela Salem dressed up in a kind of a low-cut outfit. She's on the bed being strangled. The robot's like on top of her strangling her. And as I'm watching this, I'm thinking, this is weirdly sexualized. I'm not comfortable with this. Not the least of which because her reaction to being murdered by a robot, she's got about as much resistance as the protagonist in a bodice ripper when Trevor finally comes back I mean, this for someone who's about to be murdered, she's a lot of, you know, back of her hand or her forehead going, oh, no, don't murder me. It just creeped me out. I just wasn't really comfortable with that at all.
How much of that, in all honesty, though, was that accidental thing where everybody in Doctor Who, the costume designer, the director, the writer, are all doing different things?
Yeah.
Because everyone in Doctor Who barely resists a monster killing them. Let's be honest.
Now I'm the stuffy Puritan.
I think it was like, you know, maybe there was a thought of, you know, keeping the kids' dads interested. So, Quasi.
Get that robot in here. She's ready.
I've never heard a creepier line than keeping the kids' dads interested.
Yes.
I want to see come up at a Disney picture.
I know. It was the 70s. It was the 70s were a messed up time in a lot of ways.
All I'm going to add to this, and this probably isn't going to make it into the last cut of this episode, is that Pamela Salem did later appear in the Joan Collins movie The Bitch, where she had naked lesbian scene with Joan Collins.
Well, that's on the list.
And now round four, wonderful afunctionalism. Today, Tim has brought us something special.
Yes. I know you guys have done poetic elements to your previous wonderful afunctionalisms, and this is not a poem. But it is inspired by a poem. I had my own personal Coleridge-esque Xanadu moment. Sort of fugue state.
Smoking opium.
Yes. I was watching Doctor Who out of my mind on opium.
Are you talking about the movie with Ron
Stafford? Not that. No. Well, John, I did not just do that. An ecstatic moment of hyper-awareness where I was removed from time. I was watching the season finale of the most recent season of Doctor Who, and the credits came on. And in the place where they would usually have Peter Capaldi's face, they had Clara's face. And for a singular moment in time, I had this incredible vision of a world where the Peter Capaldi's doctor was a ruse. It had really been Clara the whole time. It was a trick, and it played out in my head of how it was explained, and it made so much sense in relation to why he's constantly trying to train her. He's like, this is your decision. I can't make this decision for you because secretly you're really the doctor. And that whole world played out for me in a second before I realized that's stupid. They'd never do that. And I invite you, the rest of my fellow participants in this podcast, to if you have ever had a fugue moment of Doctor Who where you thought something was beautiful and true until you realized it would never be true.
Yeah. My moment was Waters of Mars. At the end of Waters of Mars, David Tennant goes off the rails. I am the Time Lord triumphant. To hell with these rules. I can do what I want. I am all powerful. And if they had just gone and given, I thought, oh, this is it. They're going to give me a bunch of episodes that are going to demonstrate that this is the moment that the Doctor backtracks in his own timeline and becomes the Master, which would explain why they never kill each other.
That would be awesome.
This would be awesome. Please do this one thing for me where the Doctor rolls back on himself like some sort of Gallifreyan Ouroboros, and he is the Master. It would have been the greatest thing ever, and then some girl goes in a house and blows her brains out, and that's all over. We never return to that ever again. One gunshot, bang! Oh dear.
All my dreams gone.
I should go back to being the sulky Doctor. But yeah, I there was the moment that I thought I saw a trajectory, and then pow, it was over.
Yeah, I think I've already mentioned this on the podcast before, so I'll be brief or whatever. But the fugue moment that I had was at the end of David Tennant's period where he is trapped in the radiation chamber and he's clearly taken enough to kill himself. And I thought, oh, he's just going to die here with just Wilf as his witness. And that was going to be such a fine, touching moment. But no, then he went off and he spent two commercial breaks. And,
it's the modern era. They have to say goodbye to everything that happened in his timeline.
It's perhaps a credit to the show that we watch the show and hope for things like that. That, like, we believe this show is capable of really bold moves like that.
And just like most things in life, are disappointed.
Yes.
Yeah. A podcast dedicated to our disappointment.
It wasn't. It wasn't.
Drink deep on our tears, internet.
Yeah, I can't.
Hello.
I can't. This wasn't like a disappointing thing exactly. It was more a thing I was afraid was going to happen. But
well, we all have those.
But
don't do it. Don't do it.
Don't put the fence.
When Harriet Jones in Boomtown in World War III shows up. She's an MP of no particular stature, but then like the doctor says something about like.
That doesn't she look tired?
First she says something like, you're Harriet Jones. You're going to be one of the greatest prime ministers Britain's ever had. Like, literally just flat out tells her this. And I'm already like, oh, God, no. Because I'm really uncomfortable with Doctor Who trying to do, like, near future things like that.
Yeah.
And then later on, Harriet Jones becomes prime minister, gives the command to use Torchwood's ray technology to take out this alien ship, and then the doctor is really mad at her and says the doesn't she look tired thing and like totally ruins her, and then she kind of vanishes as prime minister, and I'm like, so, greatest prime minister ever, and she was prime minister for what seems like 3 months?
Yeah, and despite knowing about her tenure as prime minister, he kind of missed the part where she blew up a bunch of aliens, and then he sank her career.
I think it's just a sign of his hilarious sense of humor. Before I ruin you, I want to build you up so you have a huge expectation of what your career is going to be.
I just point out here how stunningly naive it is of the doctor to go, hi, I knocked their boss off the top of the ship. I'm sure they'll never be back with any of their buddies. The idea that I hit them on the nose with a rolled up newspaper, we never have to worry about that pack of wild dogs ever again, blows my mind. Because it's this combination of, I don't know, of the doctor infantilizing humanity, like, you're going to do great things, but if you do them the way I don't like you to do them, I'm going to smack you with a newspaper.
The only thing I'll add to that is that this was clearly all a big plan in a Seventh Doctor way to ruin Harriet Jones, to put her into a position to sacrifice her life during the Dalek invasion in Journey's End.
Oh, yeah.
First I'm going to crush you, then I'm going to drive you to suicide.
Exactly. So, let's wrap this up. Josh, do you have a fugue moment? Are you having a fugue moment?
I think I'm
right
still
now?
In the fugue moment every time I tune in the next season. I'm like, this is going to be better.
Time freezes and you think about the Doctor Who episode you'd like to be watching.
You see first scene and you're like, I can see all the wonderful directions in which this can go.
This is going to be great. No.
So on that minor key note.
Let's move to the next round.
The death zone.
Yay!
You guys, we're gonna go into this.
We're looping in the sad trombone sound over every one of these.
We're gonna go into the death zone. No, the death zone is gonna be fun. The death zone is gonna be fun, and it's gonna be a happy way to end this particular podcast. And because what we're gonna do, we have two role-playing game experts here. For those of you who don't know, Scott Glancy is the president of Pagan Publishing, creator of Delta Green and many other fine tabletop RPG products.
Cool.
Tim Uren, of course, used to be creative developer.
Content developer. My actual role-playing game credentials, bona fides, are not nearly impressive as Scott's, but I worked on Warhammer role-playing game 3rd edition.
And that might be it. But for Fantasy Flight Games. And then you've also done a lot of freelance stuff.
Yes, a lot of board game work.
So, final round of this episode, we're going to talk about Doctor Who role-playing games, of which, to my knowledge, there are three. One published by FASA in 1985, credited to Michael P. Bledsoe and the FASA design staff. And then there was one in 1991 called Time Lord, credited to Ian Marsh and Peter Darvill Evans. Facts about this, Ian Marsh, who I don't know otherwise, was credited as having had worked on the 1985 Judge Dredd RPG.
Whoa.
Peter Darvill Evans is the guy who set up the deal with the BBC to publish the Virgin novels. So he was the general editor of the Virgin novels, which launched a lot of careers like Paul Cornell's and Lawrence Biles. The third and contemporary Doctor Who RPG is published by Cubicle 7, credited to David F. Chapman and a very large writing team. So, you guys, these are three completely different RPGs with associated modules and supplements. It's a big topic, and we can't cover 100% of everything right now, but we can poke into it a little bit.
I think the FASA and the newest Cubicle 7 version are very interesting contrasts. I think the Time Lord game is sort of a separate creature. Its mechanics aren't nearly as interesting as the other two, and it's the game specifically sort of calls on you to play the Doctor and companions.
Yes, if I remember correctly from what I've read about it, is that there's no character generation system.
When
it first came out, they just gave you a bunch of sheets that had the Doctor's stats on it and the companion stats, and you picked one and played.
Yes, they have an appendix.
No way to generate your own character.
An appendix for character generation, but it is very much an afterthought. It's much more limiting than what they give you for the other two games.
In Time Lord, the suggestion is that, like villains and vigilantes, you roll up yourself as characters and then maybe even just play your friends. Like, I would play you, Tim. Like, we would roll each other up, and I would play you, Tim, and you would play Joshua, and Joshua would play Calvin.
Hey, guys. Oh, that sounds like a great way to end friendships.
Doesn't it?
Play diplomacy.
So let's put some shape to this discussion, because we can go in a lot of different directions. So, Joshua, we're going to start with some anecdotes.
Well, I played as a child the Marvel Super Heroes role-playing game, which is what got me a little interested in role-playing, but
That was my intro to role-playing, too.
And I thought it made a lot of sense to me. I had some friends who also played it. We got together a couple times, played it. I then moved to a different school, had no friends, was very lonely, and started watching Doctor Who. I'm sure no one else can share these type of memories. And then I bought both the FASA Doctor Who role-playing game and the Star Trek one, and I was like, I'm going to be a gamer. I could not figure out the FASA one to save my life, and I had
How old were you? What was your age on this?
I was probably 12, but the jump from the Marvel superheroes to this, it was super complicated. Plus, it was just me and my brother trying to figure it out, because we had just moved, we didn't have any friends, so we didn't have anyone who could add any other insight, and it just became something that we kind of read the character stuff in, and to this day, never played a game of. And I don't know if that was me, or I'm asking you guys as gamers, was there something complicated about that?
Marvel Superheroes was a very stripped down, user-friendly game system. FASA, I feel like, still has a lot of that wargamer lineage still visible in its rules.
Absolutely. Reading it through again, I had a similar trajectory, Josh. I had the Doctor Who and Star Trek RPGs, and I did actually get in some games of the Star Trek RPG with some friends from grade school, but the Doctor Who stuff was slightly more complicated. Couldn't find people to play it with me. People knew Star Trek at my grade school, but they didn't know Doctor Who necessarily. And weirdly, it didn't quite fit. The systems are very similar, but things that work in the Star Trek RPG don't really seem to fit very well with Doctor Who. The combat stuff and movement in particular. So bear with me. I wrote down a couple of notes. So in the Doctor Who RPG, this is the FASA Doctor Who RPG, the combat rules have rules for range in squares, map squares, firing arcs, lines of sight, concealment, armor, modifiers for movement, aiming, offhand shots, size, dodge, and simultaneous attacks. There are tactical movement rules that include tactical maps, counters, dexterity-derived action point systems for movement, including position changes, movements, equipment and weapon use, dodges, and etc. And a play sequence that involves tactical advantage and opportunity actions. This is like advanced squad leader. This is really super complicated stuff.
You're making me feel better about myself.
It's all it's all derived, exactly as you say, from wargaming.
Well, this is the 80s is the time period when we we had this weird shift in role-playing games towards so-called realism. Again, this ridiculous idea that people were going to model physics with pen and paper. It's unfortunate because none of that has bupkis to do with the Doctor Who genre.
For example, explicit shotgun rules. I'm sure glad that they included the shotgun rules in the Doctor Who game.
Did they just port this from Star Trek first?
They ported it from Star Trek. That's the main thing. And it works much better in Star Trek because
Star Trek
phaser battles
has a lot of people
military
shooting
each
other.
Yeah, it has phaser battles, for example. And starship battles.
Certainly one of the reasons that you hear bandied about why the Star Trek license got pulled was that it was too military.
Yeah.
That Paramount was unhappy with the overly militaristic spin on the role-playing game.
The two things I like about the FASA system in particular is the nightmare of the game, which is that there are rules for getting the TARDIS to do what you want.
Yeah.
Which is cool, and it's what you want a Doctor Who game to do, except for when you constantly fail. And then you end up someplace that the GM did not want you to go. You are like, all right, I'm 100 years off. Now what do we do? The second thing about the FASA game is it's peculiar, at least to my experience, a game mechanic of you have a... If you're going to try to roll some dice to achieve a thing, you have a skill level and you have a difficulty level. And if your skill level is higher than the difficulty level, you just automatically pass. Other than that, you roll 2 6-sided dice, subtract the lower from the higher, and add the difference to your skill level. If it surpasses the difficulty, you succeed, which this is, sounds like gibberish when I say it out loud really fast, but it's neat. It's very sort of elegant.
Okay, we're going to move on.
Okay.
So I think
Can I just ask one question about the FASA game? Because, again, I've never played it. But the thing that, as I was reading about it, it mentioned the Celestial Intervention Agency.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was the campaign structure for the role-playing game, where you play members of the Celestial Intervention Agency. Mm-hmm. You are Gallifreyans.
Yep.
And then maybe you can pick up companions as well. I presume you could. But that campaign structure, actually, I thought that was kind of appealing, as opposed to the horrifying prospect of, here's a bunch of doctors, play one of them.
Yes.
Here's a bunch of companions, play one of them. I can't think of anything worse as a role player than, you know...
Well, everyone fights over who gets to be the doctor or something.
There's a lot of eccentric things in the FASA role-playing game. If we discard the mechanisms for a second, the narrative stuff is actually pretty interesting, because this is obviously before the new series, but even before a lot of kind of general recognition about what Doctor Who canon is. Mm-hmm. So the people building this game made up a lot of stuff, and I don't know what kind of oversight they had from the BBC, but one of the ways they got around the fact that every Doctor Who adventure is about the Doctor and subsidiary companions is by saying, well, okay, let's do this Celestial Intervention Agency, which was just a joke, essentially, that Robert Holmes made in The Deadly Assassin, but it meant that you could play a Doctor-like person and some companions and do an adventure with it. Or if you wanted to play John Pertwee and Joe or Tom Baker and Leela, you could probably manage that, too. Also, it introduced, like, weird canon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the description of the Doctor starts like this. after most of his family was killed during an attempted coup fomented by the Master, the Doctor and his granddaughter Susan fled Gallifrey. That's canon in the FASA role-playing game, which has no resemblance to anything that I've ever seen in any other Doctor Who medium ever.
The one thing I remember, maybe I'm wrong, but I remember it, so it's got to be right. The suggestion from this role-playing game that Time Lords are time-locked, which is why the Master and the Doctor always meet, and they're at the same age. They don't meet earlier versions of each other.
There's a Gallifreyan absolute time. TARDISes are connected with that. Mm-hmm. That's why the Doctor and the Master always meet each other in the same order.
You mean like Greenwich Mean Time?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Gallifreyan Mean Time is an artifact of the FASA game, not of any of the scripts from the shows.
Not that I'm aware.
Or the books.
This game.
So before we move on from the FASA game, to quickly, I think, probably cover Time Lord and Cubicle 7, I want to read one short paragraph from the player's manual of the FASA game, which is the little bit of game fiction that games of this era always included in there.
Oh, yeah. Painfully.
So, yeah, so this is to give you a sense of what a game would play like. It's interspersed with game mechanics. But the first paragraph of this game fiction called Tabby Cats and Time Lords.
Oh boy.
Goes like this. The slim intruder swung leather-clad legs over the edge of the open skylight and dropped into the main museum display room below. Cables unreeled from a black leather shoulder harness, lowering the figure smoothly to within inches of the floor, but the soft rubber soles of the silent burglar's feet were careful not to touch the floor. The dangling position left the burglar hanging just in front of the largest case. So, as we all know, this is
the Planet of the Dead.
Russell
T. Davies played some games.
Plagiarized fastest player.
If you're going to plagiarize something, don't plagiarize this.
Well, what it means is that even in 1985, people were fantasizing about the Doctor and a cat burglar for some reason. Mm. So, okay, you guys, we got to move on, though. We're running out of time here. Let's just briefly cover Time Lord. And this is a 1991 RPG that really didn't go...
Since it's 1991, isn't this the nadir of the franchise?
Yeah, it's not on the air. This is... Peter Darville Evans is one of the co-writers credited on it, and he was the guy that was doing the book line at the time, the Virgin book line at the time, and this was published under Virgin Books.
And for anyone who wants, the PDF of this game is available for free online and not in sort of an illegal way.
You can go to RPG Geek and get it. It's actually not bad. There's a lot of throat clearing at the beginning of this. This is what an RPG is like, this is what Doctor Who is like, you know, and probably maybe, I don't know, a quarter or a third of the book is actually just kind of background about the whole thing. The system itself is very rules light, and Scott, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this really seems like a forerunner of a lot of these system light things that are going on in the RPG world right now.
It is, to an extent, yes. The 90s, we'd finally, I don't know, broken the realism barrier, as it were, that had gotten so strong in the 80s, particularly with modern military role-playing system. Again, always felt like they were just squad leader, an advanced squad leader with some role-playing elements stitched onto them. And I want to say that things like White Wolf's World of Darkness had finally come out. So the rules had backed down a little bit, but even that's a giant dice pool game. It wasn't nearly as light as this, which is, again, just a 2D6 system. Not a big fan of the 2D6, but I guess when you're publishing a role-playing game book that's literally published in paperback novel format.
Yes.
It was like, what, 200 pages? It was actually a pretty thick book.
But it looked like the other books at the time. It was on the shelf. They didn't go to gaming shops. It was on the shelf. I remember picking it up thinking it was one of the novels.
Yes.
It introduced a certain number of things that wound up in some form or another in the Cubicle 7 system that's around now, particularly like the very calibrated kind of skills. There are MacGuffin special abilities, things like pseudoscience, resourceful pockets, which we talked about last episode. Screaming is an attribute.
Beneficial ability.
Yep. Serendipity. There's a cheat death special ability, which, by the way, I was interested to find out that almost all of the Doctor's regenerations and the companions had, except Adric.
That's pretty funny. Didn't they bring Adric back to life, like, explicitly in the Fossa game?
That I don't remember, unless it's in a supplement that I never had. I'm looking it up right now. Let's take a look at Adric.
That's what it was. Under the Wikipedia entry, the game detailed the character history of the Master, which included identifying the meddling monk as a previous incarnation of the Master. Game's backstory resolved the unit dating controversy by stating that the modern undead present day sequence is set in the near future, and a supplement to the game stated that Adric had not died, and that a Time Lord had rescued him in a late model TARDIS, a TARDIS more advanced than the Doctor's.
Wow.
So there. Which is really an odd detail to include in a role-playing game, is to go back and resurrect a character that you didn't think got a fair shake.
Well,
in
you know, he's got to be
Adric and Boba Fett, those two together.
Well, he's the Jason Todd of the FASA Doctor Who universe, right? He puts on the red hood, and he's got to go.
This explains a lot about why Adric is being used as the stand-in for Donnie in The Big Hubowski. Since, you know, Steve Buscemi dies and everything he does. Yeah. There you go.
You guys, we've talked a lot about Doctor Who role-playing game stuff, and I think we could talk for like another hour, but we got to wrap it up. So we've got one more to talk about, the Cubicle 7 game, which this is the one that we've actually played. Tim ran an adventure for us not very long ago, and I thought it was tons of fun. This is the one that's current right now. There are still adventures and supplements being published for it.
And it's swimming in awards, too. Let's not forget.
I think one of the first things to say about the current Cubicle 7 one is that if you are a Doctor Who fan who has never played role-playing games before, it is friendly enough game mechanics that you will pick it up easily. Vice versa, if you're a role player who's not familiar with Doctor Who, it introduces that world in a very friendly way that gives you an indication of the world, and any sort of depth is added only in sort of asides. And like,
it's actually very thin.
Yes.
Yeah.
You need to be a fan to understand what's going on.
Well, could you imagine like an actual like source book that just sort of describes everything in the Doctor Who universe?
But then, like, they have a first Doctor supplement, a second Doctor, like for each Doctor. Yeah. I think they're all the way through, except for maybe the War Doctor. But
Sure.
They have a supplemental book that goes with it. I happen to have the Eighth Doctor one. You get a sense of their boundaries, licensing wise, of they can. They can imply certain things about the Eighth Doctor, but they can't say certain things about the Eighth Doctor.
Well, guys, as the Death Zone, we have to pick a winner here.
Oh, it is the Death Zone, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, we have Calvin.
Well, I will clearly say, like, the FASA, I certainly admire for being an example of its time period.
Yes.
And for the ambition of making a game that really realistically handles time travel. But the Cubicle 7 one it serves its purpose so well.
I'm with Tim. There's a lot of charm in the FASA stuff. If you're an old school role player, you can see the trends of the 1980s in the FASA stuff. And I admire a lot of what they did to try to take an inchoate canon and try to build it into the game. But as far as just simple playability, Cubicle 7 is clearly the best one.
Yeah, same here. I really have nothing to add. Cubicle 7.
I want to insert a quick comment about the story points mechanic in Doctor Who, the Cubicle 7 one. It's a really neat way that gives players empowerment to grab control of the narrative.
And let's also throw out that unlike the FASA game, the one thing that I find interesting about the Cubicle 7 game is the mechanics that favor nonviolence. Mm-hmm. All right? Rather than all the specific stats for shotgun attacks, this thing is actually set up to add and subtract story points, which are points you can use to cheat the dice, essentially, right? They're used to change results or get you to re-roll things. Based on, again, keeping within the confines of the genre. You do not get to walk over and stab unconscious security guards to death after you've rendered them insensate. And there's that thing about how the combat in the game, the order of action was what? Talkers, runners, doers, fighters? Did you guys catch that?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you want to talk your way out of it, you know why the doctor always gets to say something snarky before someone blows his head off? It's because the order of play is talking, running away, doing something, or fighting. I suppose doing something is things like, you know, sticking a jelly baby in the end of their laser pistol, or turning the lights off, plunging the room into darkness, untying the chandelier. That always goes before shooting somebody in the face. So it was the game mechanics were actually formed to favor the genre, and I'm always in favor of games that do not try to be universal. So they definitely get the thumbs up on mechanics, but since I've never played either one or run into the materials, I can't really give them, say, which one of the stories, the adventures, the scenarios, were better. And frankly, I am sort of attracted to the idea of the Celestial Intervention Agency because it gives the players something to do that is something to hang their story around that isn't just being yet another doctor with the numbers filed off. Oh, you stole a TARDIS too and like hanging out with humans? What a coincidence, you know? So that appeals to me. But their mechanics actually kept you from playing the game. That's not a good sign.
There's a part of me that wants to sort of go back in time and figure out this FASA game to sort of redeem some frustration from my childhood, and maybe one day I will.
And some of the modules are good.
Oh yeah, I remember reading the modules, but still not being able to figure out how to make anything happen in the game. But obviously we recently played it, and it reminded me again of what made me want to pick up the FASA game after playing the Marvel Super Heroes. It seemed really accessible, it seemed fun, I had a blast with everybody, so it's hard not to just say, yeah, this Character 7 is a lot of fun.
I think it's where we're at. I mean, I think it is the current game. It's the one with the most support material. And at least in the game that we played with Tim, we didn't have to deal with one of us having to be the doctor and the others being the companions, because the conceit of the story was that the doctor was not involved.
The adventures seem set up to accommodate whatever version you want to play. You want to play the Doctor and the Companions, you want to play a unit team, you want to play some other Time Lord. It's all possible, which is awesome.
And that's our podcast. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Scott and Tim, for being our geeky guests again. And thank you, Tony Karna, for recording. I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Tim.
I'm Scott.
And we're saying, get off my world!
Guitar. And then there's a great guitar accent.
Yep.
Awesome!
Wow, five middle-aged guys discussing 70s-era Doctor Who. Okay.
And we've veered off into Joan Collins' lesbianism. Excellent!
Yes!
That's what keeps dads happy.
Speaking of things that keeps the kids' dads happy.
They gotta sit there on the couch and watch them.
If they could just strangle each other, I think we might have a product we can sell to the kids' dads.